How do we help clients who are motivated to get better but resist doing the work? Dr. Laurel Parnell says that this resistance can be less about the therapy and more about what comes after the therapy. Here, Laurel shares how to approach the fear that some clients face when they envision change.
I have trouble with the term resistance to begin with. It's like, what does that mean? It's such an old-fashioned term in a way. It's like resisting what? The therapy? What I think of it is, very often what will come up in a therapy is blocks of some kind. And it could be that they're feeling fearful. It could be that they don't know who they'll be if they get better. It may be that, as far as EMDR is concerned, it may be, wow, they're going into the unknown territory. In some cases, it's they're getting better so fast. Who will I be? And I'll lose the therapy. I'll lose the therapist if I get better. See, EMDR is a therapy where people get better really fast. And very often it can mean a change in the family system. You know, a woman who is very dependent because she was raped as a young woman suddenly becomes stronger and independent, and then it affects her marriage because her husband married this kind of quiet, dependent person. Sometimes there's this sense of like an invisible barrier to what comes after this. You know, who will I be? They can't conceptualize what it would be like to not have the problem that they've come in with. So what I do is I'll explore what the blocking beliefs are, you know, what belief is blocking you here, and address it. Maybe they need reassurance from me. Maybe they need to create more safety through adding in more resourcing and strengthening them rather than like throwing them in the deep end beyond their affect tolerance. So how do we make you feel safe? How do we strengthen you? Maybe they need more information about what we're doing. They need more education. Maybe they're not in a good place in their life to do the kind of work that they thought they wanted to do, and they're not quite ready. So it's like, okay, well, what can you do? What are you ready for? So I really believe in a client-centered approach where I'm working with the client. We're working together. And so, you know, what are the blocking beliefs? What's come up? What are they afraid of? Addressing their concerns, addressing their fears. Very often it's a blocking belief that comes up. It's like, I need my anger. Or who will I be if I don't have this problem? Or they can't believe that they could be free of it. So I'm going to look at what those blocking beliefs are, address them if I can, maybe even target them with EMDR to work on what in the past is linked to them. Very often in my consultation, I hear about therapists who are finding clients resistant to doing EMDR. And so I think in that case, I'll say, okay, so what's their hesitance? You know, what are they concerned about? And what I find in a lot of cases with clients is it's this ambivalence. It's like they really want it, but it means they're going to have experience painful feelings. So, you know, some of the ways I'll deal with it is I'll say, okay, do you want to do EMDR today? Yes, but I'm scared. Okay, so let's create more safety for you before we go in and we do this work.
And if they said no?
I'd say, okay, so why not? What's up for you right now that you don't want to? Oh, it's because I've got to give a big talk at work after this, or I'm really exhausted, or this other thing is really up for me today. So I think what's helpful is listening to what they say and really listening if it's a valid reason or if it's really something that we could address that we could then help them move forward. It's kind of like a, you know, what I think of it as a good parent. Some children will avoid everything. Anything that's a little bit painful, they'll avoid. But a good parent kind of gives them the support to move a little bit beyond their comfort zone. You know, you don't shove them past, but you just kind of gently encourage them to go a little bit beyond their comfort zone. So that's kind of where I am with that. It's trying to determine what that is. I'll give you a few examples of this. And some of these are really painful. I've worked with parents who have lost children, whose children have died. And I've worked with parents whose children have suicided and parents whose children have died from, you know, horrible diseases. And very often what they're stuck with is the idea of they're supposed to move on. You know, this people say, get on with your life, move on. Well, it's not about that. It's really about helping them heal from where they can't get the images out of their mind, or they feel guilty about something, or something's unresolved. So there was a father who came to see me because he was unable to move forward after the suicide of his daughter, his teenage daughter, and he was conflicted and he blamed himself for her death. And he was obsessed. He was obsessed with how she did it and what happened. He was replaying it over and over again. And he wanted to move on and he didn't. He was ambivalent about it. So he did incredibly with EMDR. It was extraordinary. It was one of the most moving cases of my life because I thought this might be one where it wasn't going to work, but it actually did. He was, after our work, he was no longer haunted by the images of how she killed herself because he was replaying it on a daily basis. So after we did the EMDR, several sessions of this, he was no longer playing the story, but then he felt like, who will I be if I don't have this as the center of my life? And, you know, who would I be without this pain? So he had guilt about moving on. And so we went in on that and we reprocessed the guilt about that and to give him a sense that it's okay to move on with your life. But telling him that is very different from him experiencing that. And so he was able to do that. In another case, it was another woman whose daughter had died of an awful disease when she was a young girl. And it was many years afterwards. She couldn't get over this. And there were all kinds of places where she couldn't forgive herself. And that's where she was blocked and resistant. So I found the places and I addressed them with what we call these interweaves with EMDR. And I had her imagine doing the things she wished she had done. Imagine saying things that she wished she had said. And it unlocked it. And in some other places where I asked a question about how, I'm confused, could you have known X, Y, and Z? And then she said, no, I couldn't have known. And then I said, go with that. So some of these places unlocked it. And she had been, you know, she didn't believe she'd ever be able to move forward with it. And after our session, she was actually able to distribute her daughter's ashes that she'd been carrying around for years. Another case where resistance came up was a woman who came in wanting to be able to finally get married to her longtime partner. They'd been together for years. We worked on all the blocks to the getting married. It had nothing to do with their present day relationship. And then she comes in and she says, okay, I want to work on something else now. But she, you know, each time she'd come in, I said, okay, do you have a wedding date? Do you have, you know, an engagement ring? And she'd say, no, I'm almost there, almost there. So she comes in, I want to work on something else. I said, do you have a wedding date? She said, no. I said, okay, I just want to ask you something. I'm not going to force you to work on this, but you basically hired me to do this. And what's blocking it? What's still there? So she went inside. I said, just check up inside and see what's there. And she checked up inside and she said, oh, it has to do with money. So I said, okay, is it about your partner or is it about something else? She said, it's not about him. It's about something else. So then we used a technique that I call the bridging technique. We traced it back in time. We found what it was connected to, which had to do with her parents fighting about money. We reprocessed that. We came back up to her situation with her partner now. She said, it's not about him. It's okay. The next week, she came in with an engagement ring and a wedding date. So it was like that little piece. If I had said, okay, we can work on something else, I don't think she would have gotten there. Just a little, it's like, it's an interesting little resistance, if you want. It's a block. It almost feels like, as I said, like a invisible barrier that you can't see, but it's felt on a certain level.
Dealing with these invisible barriers is an important part of the therapeutic process. But first, we have to recognize them. As Laurel said, clients can often experience fear around the idea of getting better, of what they would become then. Dr. Rick Hansen has also seen this kind of resistance to positive growth. And Rick says that in order to work with it, it requires a specific two-stage process.
It's a form of adaptation. It's a learned adaptation. So this way of thinking about it, I think is both accurate, and useful. And it's useful in part because with clients, it's much more positive. It's not like they're bad, but there's a reason they're doing what they're doing. And by honoring those reasons, that's the beginning of maintaining a good therapeutic alliance with them and going forward with helping them. The second way I think about resistance related to this is not just in terms of the function it serves, but rather the ways in which people are often understandably, to put it away, worried or concerned, or they have an expectation that if they actually start growing in the ways that they come into our office to grow, I mean, part of them does want to grow, but other parts of them, based often on history that they experienced directly or that they saw in others or that they imagined, they're concerned, generally often unconsciously or barely semi-consciously, that if they actually grow in that way, including lowering their defenses or feeling happier or feeling more loved or actually opening their heart to another person or investing themselves emotionally, let's say, in a relationship, or if they're caught visibly looking at all happy, or they stick their neck out to actually express themselves or assert themselves more fully, whatever they do, that in other words, if they go down that road, that slippery slope based on getting a little better, whack, something terrible will happen because that's what did happen to them personally, or they saw happen, or they could imagine happening. So in a funny way, sometimes people are very anxious about feeling less anxious, as an example, where they get irritated at you trying to help them get less angry, you know, like that. So that's a way of thinking about it. The last thing I'll say about how I think about resistance is in terms of the brain and learning. It's interesting to appreciate, and for me it's been very helpful to appreciate that as the nervous system evolved, there was this trade-off between speed and adaptability. Speed, jump first, ask questions later, has to do with automatic responses. So they're not very adaptable, but boy, are they quick. You're not obsessing, you know, Hamlet at the bridge, to be or not to be, to run away from the saber-toothed tiger. You know, it's like, boom. On the other hand, those automatic responses, which can be very learned, including especially through trauma, often are very rigid and they're maladaptive today in more complex settings or different settings than the person, let's say, acquired them in. On the other hand, if we can learn more new and complex ways of thinking about things and adapt to things in more complex ways, that takes longer. It takes seconds, for example, for the prefrontal cortex to really come online in a judicious, nuanced, complex way that really does recognize the whole mosaic of reality out there or reality in here, rather than just acting really rapidly with regard to just one flashing red light tile in that mosaic. So there's this natural tension, and some people are more inclined toward automatic rapid processing. Some people are more inclined toward slower, less efficient, but more adaptable processing. And that's just natural. And what we're trying to do with people is help them unlearn, in effect, some of those rigid automatic processes that were adaptive and are often rooted in regions. As you go down the neuroaxis, you go down in time, in the subcortex and then brainstem, those regions of the brain have much less neuroplasticity. They're less amenable to change. So therefore, they need a lot of counter experiences, a lot of new lessons if they're going to actually build new neural structure or function or alter function down there in the basement, if you will, of the museum of the mind. And so anyway, thinking about that is really helpful for me. All right. So what to do about it, right? Okay. Let's see here. All right. Several things I would just say. One is to join with the defense, classic psychoanalytic term. Instead of resisting the defense or resisting the resistance or shaming a client, oh, there you go again, you know, or anything like that, or leaking attitude, in our micro expressions toward our clients, they are very quick at picking that up. Instead of doing that, it's no, join with the defense. Hey, what's good about it? What are the benefits of doing that? You know, what are the payoffs? It's a little tricky to use that as a word, but what are the rewards? What are the functions it serve? How does it help you? And then there's kind of an exploration of that. It's like a jiu-jitsu move, and it's very effective to do that. It's maybe sometimes for many people, it's actually the first time anyone has ever done that with them with regard to the way they are. you know, to go, no, the way you are is great. It serves all kinds of good functions. That's just stage one. Stage two, of course, is to think about a different way to serve the same functions that are more effective, nuanced, appropriate, less inclined to drive your partner or your children or your coworkers or your boss crazy, less costly in terms of long-term wear and tear on your body, mind, you know, across the lifespan. But that's stage two. So stage one, joining with the defense, understanding it, appreciating the functions, accepting it, reducing the collateral damage of internal issues about the defense, where often that's what we deal with. The person's ashamed of being this way, or they're angry at themselves for being this way, or they don't want to admit they're being this way. We have to kind of work through that crud just to get to the defense, just to get to the coping strategy. That's a different way of saying the same thing. But if we don't get to it, all our well-intended efforts, that's one reason why a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy and other forms that kind of tend to be, not always, I'm not being critical of them, but they can be fairly superficial if we just stay out at the level of, you know, twigs and leaves. If we don't get to the trunk and the root of the tree, the real source, then we just get symptom substitution if we don't get to the roots of things. So for many people, joining with that defense is fundamental. It puts us on solid ground. Then we can actually go forward with them. And then when we go forward, we're in the exploration of what might be alternative ways of acting. And what I find about that, that's a critically important step that I've tended to leave out sometimes, and then it hasn't gone so well, and I can see others in our profession leaving it out. It's not enough to name or teach the alternative coping strategy. You know, what would it be like to count to 10 before you say something? Or what would it be like to speak to yourself differently inside your own mind? Or what would it be like to lean forward into that interaction with your partner rather than, you know, leaning back when your partner has some kind of unmet need or want? What would that be like? That's not enough. What we need to do as well is associate that to some reward. Some healthy, authentic reward. It could be a subtle reward, like an internal sense of relief or ease that it actually goes better when they act in this new way, or the externally originating reward that another person is happier with them or praising of them, including the therapist, or respectful or appreciative, or is more willing to get vulnerable themselves or form a closer connection, or, you know, happily maybe go to bed with them, actually, you know, to internalize those various rewards. Because if we don't associate reward, and I mean that term very broadly in wholesome senses, if we don't internalize reward with that new way of being, the brain is going to tend to default to those old ways of being that were associated with many rewards, including the reward of the avoidance of expected pain. So we need to, you know, realize we're competing, you know. Don't underestimate the power of the dark side of the force. Of all those acquired rewards, again, the brain has designed negativity bias to overlearn from negative experiences. So if we're going to try to nudge this person into being a different way, we need to really associate rewards with that different way.
Our negativity biases are so powerful, and they can keep our clients stuck in their suffering. In the next module, we'll look at some practical ways to calm the nervous system when clients are in the defensive state. I'll see you there.